And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. How's everybody?
Pretty good.
Great.
Doing great. Glenn, what do you do for NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor for NPR.org.
Stephen Thompson, you are not important.
Fair enough.
But what do you do?
Also, I'm an editor and writer at NPR Music.
Well, thank you very much. Anyway, I am just going to start off this show right now by gloating.
You're good.
What are we gloating about now?
Goody.
Oh, I'm going to gloat. You may recall from last week's show that Glenn's thing making him happy was that it was going to be Free Comic Book Day. And what didn't make it to the show but happened off air was that Glenn had offered to come and take me and Stephen to the comic book shop. And here's the reason why this offer was made, is that he was very confident that we would never go unless taken, right? There was some scheduling hassles, and we weren't able to make that work. But I want it noted for the record, I went.
Good for you.
I went all by myself.
You did.
I found my local comic shop in Silver Spring. Mm-hmm. I went down there. I walked in the door. I found a bunch of comics. I bought a couple things.
Good for you.
I supported my local comic shop, even without being taken by the hand, Glenn Weldon.
Well done.
Awesome.
Well, I will have you know that I paid lip service to Free Comic Book Day on last week's podcast. So I've done my part.
Yeah. I pretty much just watched you all have fun with that and stayed home and read a book. So
I went. And I have read some of my free comics.
Good. What'd you get?
That's great.
Oh, I got a bunch of them. I got the Thor Captain America.
Good. Mm-hmm.
Which I will lend to you because you tweeted that about the fact that you did not have it. I will remember to bring it for you. Oh, I got the Spider-Man thing, which had more to it than the...
Oh, did it?
Yeah. It's actually a whole thing. It's not just... It has words and stuff.
Was this going to be a poster of Spider-Man like scaling
you
the wall?
You do not read my blog, Stephen Thompson.
No, I don't.
Where Glenn had explained that it looked like this might just be a preview of like essentially... uncolored art with no words.
Yeah. Gotcha.
It's a whole thing. Lock and Key I got.
Good.
Oh, one of the ones I bought, and this is completely not to my taste at all, as you will know as soon as I say it, but I bought a Punisher, and the reason...
Really?
The reason is that they had a really funny sign that someone had put up next to it. Clearly someone who works there just really loved it and like went on for a paragraph on this little sign about how much they loved it. So I basically just gave like $4 to the sign.
Good for you.
Because I thought it was awesome.
And here I thought you were going to say that you took home the graphic novel version of The Hobbit.
I didn't, but...
There are one or two.
It's funny
17.
That you should mention that, Trey Graham, because I am not able yet to provide an adequate replacement for the copy of The Hobbit that was pinched from my desk.
People have been asking about this,
it's
actually.
True.
I know.
We could provide a little backstory here. That,
yes.
Sometime last fall...
when Glenn made his fruitless effort to get Linda Holmes to read The Hobbit.
Glenn was encouraging me to read The Hobbit and loaned me his 50th anniversary edition of The Hobbit, which
collector's
I had.
Edition.
It was like cloth bound.
It was not gold.
No, but it was like gold foil. And
It was very... Don't rub it in. It was very attractive.
Fancy pants.
I was reading it and I had it at work and it disappeared from my desk. Now,
you read what, 3 pages?
This is not the point. Anyway... I have not been able to replace that exact thing without dealing with sketchy people on eBay who I don't know anything about.
You mean sellers?
Who I suspect will actually not send it to me. But...
Are you afraid of eBay?
I didn't know this.
Why don't you be quiet?
We've buried the lead. Linda is afraid of eBay.
Why don't
you discuss that?
Anyway, I have acquired a, not the same, but a hardback copy of The Hobbit. Which I will give
Glenn
you.
Glenn is shaking his head.
Doesn't matter. The other.
As a temporary replacement until I can find a better one.
It's fine.
But, no, you've not heard the lead yet. Mm-hmm. But I didn't bring it for you. Do you know why I didn't bring it for you?
Because you're traveling back in time to have it inscribed by Tolkien.
You want to memorize the song so you can sing them to me?
No, I did not bring it to you because I'm reading it.
Really?
I'm just saying.
Excellent.
Let the record show that Linda just raised the roof.
Yeah, she wasn't just saying. She was also raising the roof.
I said, and I raised the roof. So that's how I wanted to start the show this week, just by passing along my news.
Yep.
My news on both fronts, the Free Comic Book Day front and also the Hobbit front.
Two bits of good news. Great.
Bits of good news. Passed along from me to Glenn. Anyway, speaking of things we did this weekend... we have engaged in another one of our rare experiments with research in that we have all banded together and we have seen Thor.
Thor.
Thor. As you can hear, we are all terribly excited about Thor. I'm going to let somebody else start. Trey, why don't you start?
I would just like to observe. I'd like to start this ball rolling by saying I don't think that anyone, with a possible exception of Mike Katzeff, is going to argue that this is the best Marvel superhero movie ever. But I would like to ask if that's really the metric we need for this conversation. Because this is arguably a better superhero movie than The Green Hornet and a better movie about severe weather than Twister. So there's that.
Right? It is definitely a better movie about severe weather than Twister.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's way better than The Green Hornet, but that's a low bar.
How did you feel about it, Glenn?
Thought it was super.
could have said Thorific as well.
I could have said that. I chose not to.
You said super. That's better.
I've always had my problems with his character. He's sort of a jerk. He's sort of pompous. And, you know, he's constantly coming down to earth to be humbled.
Thor, Odin's son, you have betrayed the express command of your king. Through your arrogance and stupidity, you have opened these peaceful realms and innocent lives to the horror and desolation of war! You are unworthy of these realms, unworthy of your title! You're unworthy! I now take from you your power, in the name of my father, and his father before, I own it, your father! Cast you out!
This is his equivalent of Aunt May needs medicine for Spider-Man. It's the same thing that happens over and over again. It gets a little boring. But, you know, I like the way this thing was structured. It was great to see him kind of putting the hammer down, literally,
as it were,
in sort of a fantasy world with the big giant guys. Then seeing him just fighting, you know, as a normal human being, some normal human beings. And then building up to the last moment where we see him bringing the thunder in the real world, which is the setting that, you know, most of the comic takes place in.
Right. It will not be a spoiler.
That's not a spoiler.
It's not really a spoiler to say that at some point in this movie, Thor gets his hammer back and gets to wail on the bad guys.
Right.
I thought it looked good. I mean, you know, Asgard looks like a Maxfield Parrish pipe organ for reasons that escape me, but it looks, you know, Wagnerian, suitably Wagnerian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is Kenneth Branagh, and he could have made his Henry V again, or he could have made his Hamlet again. And I was hoping it wasn't going to be Hamlet, because that was a really long movie. Mm-hmm. This struck me as more Henry V. It still had some slow moments. What'd you guys think?
To provide a little bit of a backdrop to what Glenn is saying, the director is Kenneth Branagh. Is this his first non-Shakespeare?
Dead Again was one of his earliest movies.
Sure.
Dead Again was genre, and it's worth sort of reminding people that he had at least a little bit of background in genre before.
I think one of the things that we talked about coming out of this movie is that the beginning of it, as you mentioned, is pretty slow. I thought it was pretty slow. Mm-hmm. But you will recall that I have the same reaction to the lengthy Brando business at the beginning of Superman, mm-hmm. that I found it incredibly slow.
Get to the fireworks factory.
And set up, and kind of set up-y. In some of the same ways, it's very ponderous. It's all the origin story, like, now you shall be this, and you shall be that, and I shall be that, and the son, and the father, and the who, and the who, and the who, and it goes on and on and on. And I felt the same way about this, that I could not believe it. It takes like 45 minutes to get to Christopher Reeve. It's really, really long. All this stuff with Marlon Brando and the council and the destruction of the downy fabric softener planet or wherever they are. And it goes...
Building.
It's
building
slow, but
endless. It goes on forever. And I had the same reaction to this.
To be fair to Thor, and I agree, I thought the film started pretty slowly. Not only slow-paced, but very cumbersome exposition-y stuff. The scene that had me very, very worried about where this movie was going to go was the one where the scientists are talking, and Stellan Skarsgård is sort of like, "You're a brilliant physicist, not a storm chaser. You know, you have 4 degrees in data transfer." Transmogrification, and you know, there's a lot of this sort of.
As you will remember,
you are a physicist. You know, there's a certain amount of that early on that just had me go, and that combined with the sort of slow pace of probably only about the first 15 or 20 minutes, mm-hmm. had me very concerned. But it is important to remember that Thor, unlike Superman, is not necessarily a character that is all that prominent in the public consciousness.
Right. And it's worth noting, too, I think that the conflict between Odin and Thor, father and son, that gets set up in the beginning does get brought back. It gets referred to, and it informs the outcome, again, without wanting to spoil anything. It informs what happens toward the end of the movie with Thor and Loki.
Sure. You have to do that work at the beginning of setting up the relationships because you have to set up the stakes. And I get all that. I'm not saying it shouldn't have been there. I think it maybe could have been a little bit less heavy in tone compared to the rest of the movie.
Well, there is something else going on here. You have an origin story, but only kind of, sort of, because this guy's already a god. There's no discovery. And this is what really grabs you about superhero origins is when Superman finds out he can fly, when Batman, makes the first Batarang, when Spider-Man realizes he can climb the walls. That's wish fulfillment. And that's a thing that's really primal, and that's what a power these movies have. And you don't have that with this particular guy because he's already a arrogant, gorgeous.
And I already know what this is like.
Yes, of course you do. The other thing, speaking
that's of not wish fulfillment, that's just Thursday.
speaking of the characters, in the comics, Loki, his brother, is just this really evil, like mustache twirling kind of evil. And this was essentially the origin story of how Loki turns evil. In the beginning, he's just a sort of minor mischief maker, but he doesn't really emerge as really the villain of the piece for a long while.
But he becomes evil sort of through, without spoiling too much, but that sort of through his changing relationships with the family and how he feels about sibling rivalry and all that.
So this struck me as
taking away the sibling rivalry and the family stuff that sort of has been laid on the top of this by Marvel, the friendly trickster character is a little more in line with what we actually know from mythology, right?
Sure.
Am I getting that right?
Yeah. He's a lot of people who've dealt with him over the years have kind of played with him as just sort of outright evil or just sort of somebody who just likes to get under Thor's buff skin.
And in that Captain America Thor crossover that I got on Free Comic Book Day, look at me bringing information.
Wow.
They treat him much more trickster-like. Yeah. Like, I mean, it has elements of being evil, but it has also elements of banter and kind of like, he's just kind of like a guy who'll come up and be like, hey, Broham, and it's like just
Broham.
It's just this kind of goofy.
Yeah. I suspect this is the origin story of Loki and the he's going to come full four in the Avengers film.
Right.
Because I think he's going to play a larger role in the Avengers film, and he'll be the crazy evil guy.
So, you know what is exciting me the most about this new Thor mania that has swept the US of A? It is a chance for me to contact my mother and talk to her about the two issues of Thor that she and my dad wrote the plots for.
Excellent.
And to dig up these old treasured family heirlooms here, I have a scan of the cover of Thor 280 from a plot by Don and Maggie Thompson. My parents wrote the plot, which was then written by Roy Thomas. Mm.
And who was the artist?
It was penciled by Wayne Boring and inked by Tom Palmer.
Cool.
And on the cover, a buff caped villain is punching Thor, and he's saying, "Hang up your hammer, Thunder God. You're just an Asgardian also ran compared to the atomic fists of Hyperion."
Come on.
Wow.
Come on. What's going to be wrong with that?
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
So I was delighted to, on Mother's Day, talk to my mother about the issues of Thor that she helped write. And Thor 280 and the Thor Annual number 8. so all of you with massive, voluminous collections of Thor can go and read my parents' plotting.
Well, you want to talk about your parents. I want to talk about how buff Thor is.
Yeah.
I want to indulge Glenn in this conversation that I think we all need to have. Yep.
The thing that's making me happy about this new Thor mania is shirtless, buff, blonde men.
Okay. I was going to say, 75% of us in this conversation really enjoyed this the most. Maybe 100%.
Let's start from the very specific and work outward. Let's build slowly. The look of this film, they really...
The left pec.
No. I'm going to get there.
Hairless.
I'm going to get there. So the look of this film, they really nailed the costumes. Like, Loki in the comics has this ridiculous curvy helmet. They got it right. Mm. The thing that Jack Kirby used to do is draw Thor, and everybody since then has done the same thing, draw Thor so that his cape doesn't fall on his shoulders. It has kind of a little rampy thing, kind of goes up off of it. And they had a little rampy thing.
Mm-hmm.
They nailed the little rampy thing. But yes, let's talk.
That's the headline.
Let's talk shirtlessness. My God, this guy looks like an action figure. This guy looks like a superhero in a way.
We should say Chris Hemsworth. Australian Chris Hemsworth.
Lately, when your hero spends any time, of any kind of film, spends even 3 seconds of the film shirtless, that shot will be in the trailer. It could be a documentary about the plight of Andalusian beet farmers, and there will be a scene. If he takes off his shirt, it's going to be in the trailer. And this is a recent phenomenon. The film Charlie St. Cloud, the Zac Efron film, there is a shot in the trailer of him just whipping off his shirt for no reason. Doesn't connect to anything. It's just, and also, nipples. That's pretty much what the... Right.
It connects to nipples, certain things.
The nipples you've been dying to see.
Maybe it doesn't connect to you.
But, you know, that scene in the film, Tyrus Hambrith steps out of the bathroom. He's got on some very low-cut jeans, where we see a little V thing that he has right there at his waistline, little shelfie thing.
A little shelfie thing. And that is the biological term.
And he just stands there for... He's got the T-shirt in his hand.
Right. There is no reason for him not to be putting the T-shirt on.
There is no reason.
There's a reason.
Well, this is the thing. He walks
talking about it right now.
This scene goes on for really a long time. It's the only shirtlessness in the entire movie, but it's quality shirtlessness. And it lingers. And what I'm asking you, Linda Holmes, is I have always been told by women of my acquaintance that we women, we're not visually stimulated. We prefer words.
Who told you that?
We much prefer
that
words.
That doesn't sound like women of your acquaintance. That sounds like men of your acquaintance.
No.
Talking on behalf of women of your acquaintance.
They've always, I mean, it's crap on the face of it, because otherwise, you know, Playgirl would actually have some women readers, which... I guess it does.
Look, that's a ridiculous thing to say. Yes. Everybody is visually stimulated. There are obviously other things that figure into attractiveness, and perhaps we could argue in some other setting other than a discussion of Thor, how those things, what the interplay is. But obviously, yeah, he's very attractive.
Right.
The point is, I think, if you're asking whether, even for women who are not necessarily the most obvious target audience of this movie, are they playing into the tastes of women by having him walk around with his shirt off, I would bravely say they just might be.
Yes, I would say that, you know, this scene and, you know, maybe a handful of others that we've noticed like it are evidence that the makers of these particular kinds of big summer comic book films are finally doing a little more on behalf of the ladies who have been dragged all unwillingly with their boyfriends to see it, and the gay comic book fanboys.
Yeah, I wouldn't discount that. We are legion, let me just say. Yeah.
No,
there's a lot of us.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I'm just speaking for my part of the equation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we haven't even talked yet about what I actually think is the strongest part of the movie, which is when he goes down to Earth and he's hanging out with the scientists who are, as Stephen mentioned, Stellan Skarsgård and Natalie Portman.
Mm-hmm.
Appealing to me more than she has in a while.
Yeah, it's surprising.
And Kat Dennings, who I think is actually the scene stealer for me.
Oh, totally.
Kat Dennings as the intern, who has a couple of just
she gets to drop a bunch of funny one-liners.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they appear to be doing research into interstellar physics and comic timing.
Is
what's happening.
And he actually has some comic chops.
He turns out to be not bad.
Held himself well. I would argue that the thing that wasn't funny were the three warrior friends.
Yeah.
The Warriors Three, as we call them.
I didn't get that.
Who are not funny in the way that Shakespeare clowns are not funny.
It's the exact same breed of not funny.
It's like, he's fat and he likes food. Look at that.
You know what?
That's not Shakespeare.
Trey just smacked you with a white glove.
I'm going to posit something, Glenn, and maybe you and I can agree on this. It has never been funny to show anyone with a poultry leg hanging out of their mouth. It is a comic trope that you will have the big, lusty, hungry dude, and he will have a big, old, freaking turkey leg hanging out of his mouth. It's not funny.
And that is not funny in and of itself. It's funny if there's good writing around it, and that was lacking.
I agree. I think those characters were the place where the movie fell down the most. And also, poor Rene Russo. I felt.
Oh my God, talk about underused.
Thor's mother, who doesn't even appear to have a name. She has like three lines.
That she's the goddess of something or other.
Glenn, hold on. Glenn, what's her name?
Oh, I can't remember. I don't know.
If she's the queen of the gods, she's Frigga. But if she's Thor's mother, she's somebody else.
Yeah, I think she's Frigga.
Yeah, but I think for her, for that particular actress, it's a little bit sad to have her reduced to the kind of your father has reasons for the things he does.
Not to be spoiler, but when she does pick up the sword, I'm like, she's picking up the sword. Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah.
Dropped the sword.
Right. She's not a super effective fighter.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
It's an auspicious start. It's not certainly not the best Marvel superhero movie, and I do think that's a valid metric. He's a tough character to pull off. He's not relatable in the sense that Peter Parker is relatable.
Not as good as Iron Man 1 or Spider-Man 1 or 2.
Nope.
But better than a bunch of them.
Yeah. And I want to note one more tiny thing, which is that I was very, very confused by looking at the guy in the helicopter and thinking, that's Jeremy Renner.
Yeah.
Why is Jeremy Renner in this movie for 10 seconds? That doesn't make any sense. And then I got home and I read that this is a guy who will show up again in The Avengers. Yes. So
why would you throw away an actor?
Well, I thought, clearly I'm confused. That cannot possibly be him, but that, of course, it was.
But that thing that's confusing you is delighting legions of Marvel fans.
Absolutely.
who were saying this is what Marvel Comics does. They build an entire world and they have it all connect. Mm-hmm. And
Coulson is in is in this and was also in...
He was in Iron Man. He's been in a bunch of them lately.
Well, they throw in the little references to Stark. And,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yep. mm-hmm.
and obviously Stan Lee. I thought Stan Lee's cameo was cute.
It was one of the better ones.
Yeah. So I thought overall I did think it worked pretty well. And our next topic, we were going to talk a little bit about summer movies in general. So maybe we will go to Glenn first to mention a couple of summer movies that you are sort of, you know, where are you with regard to summer movies? We talked a little bit about summer movies as part of our movies of 2011 preview that we did months ago, but we have significantly more information about a lot of
these now. I was going to say, now we know something about them.
And we've seen trailers, and we're not speaking strictly from blurbs and casting. So so what are you thinking, Glenn?
Well, let me just dispense with the upcoming superhero films really quickly, because we already talked about them a little bit. But there's four. It's a superhero summer. There's Thor, and the next comes X-Men First Class, which is a prequel to the X-Men mm-hmm. films, sort of rebooting the franchise. There's Green Lantern, and then there's Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing about a superhero film. How good your superhero film is depends on how good your villain is. And there's a rule that I have just come up with.
While sitting here.
You got four potential villains that will guarantee awesome film. We're going to go to them in ascending order of awesomeness, starting with number four. Your aliens, fighting aliens, safe bet. Who's going to disagree with that? Number three, your giant robots. It's always good to fight a giant robot. You can't go wrong. And I would argue that Thor did that. Okay, granted, it was technically a mystical suit of armor.
Sure.
But, you know,
it was close enough to a robot.
Close enough to a giant robot. Mm-hmm.
It shot fire out of its face.
Exactly.
So.
It did.
Coming in at number two is your apes. Especially your super intelligent telepathic apes.
Mm-hmm. Seriously, now, what are you coming up with that is better than apes?
Oh, you'll see.
Oh, wait, I think I know the answer to this.
But see, you got these three. The thing about aliens, giant robots, and apes, they're united in what I call their puny human factor. All of these three things can call, especially if it's a talking ape, helps if it's a talking ape, can say things like, obey, puny human, or quake with fear, puny human, or I gotta pick up my laundry, puny human, whatever mm-hmm. one of those three things. Your number one, coming in at number one, and this is indisputable, this is fact, the number one thing you want your superhero to fight, Nazis.
Yep.
Everybody loves
fighting
Nazis.
I knew that's where he was going. I knew it. Yeah.
Which is why, you know, Green Lantern's fighting aliens. X-Men First Class from the trailer seems to be fighting communism. I'm not exactly sure what they're fighting, which is, you know, which is not bad. Captain America fighting Nazis.
Yeah.
Come on. What's going to be better than that? So I'm looking forward to Captain America most.
Mm. Very, very good. Trey Graham, summer movies.
I am going to tell you about The Top Twins. The T-O-P-P twins. It is apparently a kind of affectionate portrait of what IMDb describes as New Zealand's finest lesbian country and western singers and the country's greatest export since Rack of Lamb. It's in limited release this week. And it sounds like a fun film.
So you're excited about that.
Lots of
CGI explosions.
Yes,
in that one.
I think so.
Will you be seeking it out?
I might. I might just. We'll have we have a review of it on the website by the time you hear this. So.
Very
yes,
good.
I'm curious about that.
Very good.
I have to say,
now,
I'm scrambling now because that was my choice, and I guess instead I'm going to have to go with Kung Fu Panda 2.
Which is coming up in a couple of weeks, the same weekend as Hangover 2, which may require me to take a couple of days off. Hangover 2 and Kung Fu Panda on the same weekend?
You're excited.
How will
about
I get
Hangover
anything
2?
Else done?
Wow.
I really liked The Hangover.
Right.
Oh, yeah?
I really liked The Hangover.
All right, Stephen Thompson, you mentioned Kung Fu Panda 2.
Kung Fu Panda 2.
Do you know anything about Kung Fu Panda 2?
I know it's going to be great.
Do you know anything about the plot?
Well, I'm guessing that it involves fighting a new and more terrifying enemy than they fought the first time.
Maybe it's Nazis.
I hope it's not.
Maybe Kung Fu Panda has to fight Nazis.
You know what I hope it is? I hope it's Nazi alien robots.
Do you think it's possible that he'll lose his powers and have to relearn all the skills?
I'm guessing, if the ad campaign is not telling lies, this is going to be an even greater adventure than the first time. As we've stated many, many podcasts ago, I think Kung Fu Panda's awesome. I will be first in line for Kung Fu Panda 2. And looking over the summer list, I see, boy, do I see a lot of numerals.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I mean, I know we say that every summer, but it just seemed like every damn movie. I think that's why I'm excited about Captain America. It's just because it's not a reboot of something. Mm-hmm. It's not a sequel to something. Has there ever been a Captain... Oh, they've tried to make Captain America movies before. Didn't one turn out to be direct-to-video?
There was one in the 80s that was kind of a companion to The Incredible Hulk on television. They tried to launch it as a television series, and it was really lame.
But looking at the summer, we've got Kung Fu Panda 2, The Hangover 2, Pirates of the Caribbean Part 12.
Stranger, boring.
The Curse of Johnny Depp's Deep Set Eye Wrinkles. Cars 2, Harry Potter and the Prince
Eight.
Of
Heavy And the
Books.
Adult Onset Diabetes and the Harry Potter and the Middle Age Spread.
Spy Kids 4, Piranha 3 Double D.
There you go.
Oh, nice.
It knows what it is, though. You got to give it to it.
Yeah, it's not hiding. in December, Alvin and the Chipmunks. Chipwrecked?
No.
Yes! So we can stop making squeakquel jokes. We can now make chipwrecked jokes.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yes, as Bob Mondello put it, there are 27 sequels this year, and he broke them down as follows. 9 part 2s, 5 3s, 5 4s, 5 5s, 2 7s, and 1 8, which is actually Harry Potter part 7 part 2.
Judy, Moody, and the Not Bummer Summer, which I'm excited about entirely because I have already given my daughter two pink promotional boas.
So your point is, lots of sequels coming up.
Lots of sequels.
All right. Well, my first pick is not a sequel, but I'm extremely excited about it, and I'm finally able to talk about it. It has been embargoed. You're not supposed to be talking about it, but people are anyway. Bridesmaids is opening this Friday. I saw it a couple weeks ago. I really, really liked it. I thought it was very, very good, and it is the first movie I've probably ever seen where the women in it who are friends relate to each other in a way that bears any resemblance to the way that I relate to my friends and the things that we do that crack each other up. Because women who are friends in movies tend to spend all their time either boohooing around being depressed or angsting about job and men or shopping or stuff like that.
Wait.
They don't just have fun together. They don't have inside jokes. They don't crack
fights.
Each other
up. You guys
have
up. Lots of pillow fights.
Exactly.
So I have it on good authority.
They don't just crack each other up. They don't have, you know, silliness that it feels in any way familiar to me. There's an early scene between Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph, who are best friends in the movie. And I watched it and I sort of sat there with my mouth hanging open. I thought, this is like actual women talking to each other. And you don't know how rare it is until you see it. And all of a sudden you think, oh, these aren't movie women. Mm-hmm. These are women like women. And it was terribly, terribly exciting to me. It is a Judd Apatow produced comedy. It was written by Kristen Wiig. And pardon me, there is another woman. I don't remember her name. It's also directed by Paul Feig, who worked on Freaks and Geeks and has done a lot of really, really good stuff. It's just excellent, and I really, really recommend it, even though it has slow parts, it has a couple of dumb parts. It also has an incredibly charming love story. Huge, huge recommendation from me on that movie.
Well, a lot of the comedy nerds in my Twitter feed are just raving about that film. It's
excellent.
Yeah.
It just was excellent. I was tickled by it. I want there to be lots more movies like it, and I salute everybody involved. It's excellent.
Do we think this is a movie that could sort of plug into one of the things we talked about last week, which is how do you make movies that support the idea that women will come out to the movies for a big budget movie that's a big hit that presents female characters in an interesting way?
I certainly hope so. So go, take your friends. Yep. You know, the other one I want to mention just briefly is Friends with Benefits with Mila Kunis and Justin Timberlake. Cannot go wrong. I don't care what you say.
The second movie of its kind this year.
The trailer has come out, and unlike the one with Ashton Kutcher and Natalie Portman, the trailer of this one is funny, which makes sense because Mila Kunis and Justin Timberlake are funny. And Woody Harrelson is in it, and in the trailer he is funny. And I do not care what anybody says. Glenn Weldon is making his little sad face. I don't care. I like it. I like the trailer. I'm excited. I want it to be good. That's where I am on summer movies.
Speaking of, looking forward to to August. I know it's a little ways away, but I have seen the trailer for The Help, which is based on that novel that Linda has written about on the blog, that novel about the Mississippi woman and her housekeeper and the sort of community of housekeepers and all during the civil rights era in what is it, Jackson, Mississippi, I think. If you have not been keeping up with the coming attractions news on this movie, the casting is D-damn-licious. It is Emma Stone from Easy A, our girl from Easy A, Viola Davis, who I would watch in anything. But also, you've got Leslie Jordan playing the newspaper editor. You've got Allison Janney is in it. Octavia Spencer is in it. Bryce Dallas Howard is in it. Dana Ivey and Sissy Spacek are in it. It's a tight-looking little ensemble, and I know that at least Allison Janney and Octavia Spencer have worked with the director before, which is kind of interesting because the director is apparently a friend of the woman who wrote the novel, and it's only his second big feature, I think, or second feature of any kind. I think he's done a short, his name is Tate Taylor. He's, I think, a little better known as an actor, but not terribly well known even for that. But it looks like he's got sort of a history with Janney and some of the other core players here, and that strikes me as kind of promising. And like I said, I've seen the trailer, and although it is kind of emphasizing the sweet and the funny beats in the story, it looks like it could be fun.
Excellent.
You talk about a dynamite cast, the movie of the year. I mean, we're talking about Angelina Jolie, Gary Oldman, Seth Rogen, Jack Black, Jackie Chan, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Dustin Hoffman, David Cross, Lucy Liu, Kung Fu Panda 2.
I get it.
You know, The Help is an interesting example of counter-programming. You know, it's not a typical summer fare. Doesn't seem like it. The other example is Tree of Life, which is coming out at the end of this month. It's a Terrence Malick film, Brad Pitt and a bunch of people, and the trailer is all about a father and a son and their existential crisis and all these shots of lawns for no reason. And this is the kind of film that the 20-year-old, horribly pretentious Glenn would have eaten up with a spoon, but the 40-something-year-old, still just as pretentious, but much more self-conscious about it.
He would just mention it on a podcast.
He would. I'm just going to say this. This is not for me. This is not what I'm looking for. I think it comes out either near or opposite Kung Fu Panda. So,
forget it.
Right opposite Bridesmaids. The other film that's coming out this Friday is Priest, in which Paul Bettany plays a post-apocalyptic priest who is fighting vampires, and his crucifixes are throwing stars.
Yes!
And really, I really want Bridesmaids to succeed, so if Priest beats Bridesmaids, I'll be kind of depressed. Yeah. As awesome as Priest looks.
Yeah. Well, I encourage all of you to patronize Bridesmaids and not Priest or any other movie this weekend. Please, please. I want more comedies where I recognize the women. Anyway, so that brings us to our final segment this week and every week, which is What's Making You Happy This Week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
All right. Well, this has already been all over the internet today. People keep sending it to me, and I that's fine. But I first read about it yesterday, Sunday, on the Pop Culture Happy Hour Facebook page. It was sent in by one Raymond Chen, so thank you, Raymond. This was a correction that was made in the Sunday New York Times. I'm going to read it in my New York Times voice.
Okay.
An item in the Extra Bases baseball notebook last Sunday misidentified, in some editions, the origin of the name Orchrist the Goblin Cleaver, which Mets pitcher R.A. Dickey gave as one of his bats. Orchrist was not, as Dickey had said, the name of the sword used by Bilbo Baggins in the Misty Mountains in The Hobbit. Orchrist was the sword used by the dwarf Thorin Oakenshield. (Parentheses) Bilbo Baggins' sword was called Sting. Close parentheses.
Subscription canceled!
So much of this makes me happy. So much. That it appeared in the Extra Bases baseball notebook. And this touch off a round of, excuse me. I hope somebody got fired over that blunder. Are we expecting some kind of magical xylophone? That sort of thing. Because this just goes to prove that nerds is nerds. And people who will read the Extra Bases baseball notebook are just socially sanctioned nerdism, right? And we are all of a piece. The other thing I like is that technically Orchrist, it's not called Orchrist the Goblin Cleaver. It's called Orchrist, which is the Sindar name, which translates to Goblin Cleaver. Goblin Cleaver. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't go calling Gandalf's sword Glamdring the Foehammer, would you? No.
I would not.
I sure wouldn't.
I am guessing I would not.
No, it's Glamdring, which means the Foehammer. That may be
so. So what you're saying is there needs to be a correction to the correction.
Yeah, you should file a correction to the
technically,
correction.
Technically,
I bet. Should write an angry letter.
I am confident enough in my people that it's already in the works.
Excellent. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
The Book of Mormon.
Oh, sure.
And by this, I do not mean the Book of Mormon, about which I
have an announcement
about which
to make,
about which I do not officially have an opinion,
right.
You know, because I like my job.
Right.
But the Book of Mormon, the Broadway musical, of course, it is a gigantic hit. It's the story of two fresh-faced young Mormons who are sent off on their mission, and they are assigned to a small and poverty-stricken village in Uganda, which is a place where they find themselves completely out of their depth. And the original cast album is not available to you just yet, but you can go to the NPR Music website and listen to it streaming in its entirety.
NPR Music.
So when you are done listening to this podcast, that is where you should go. Or you could pull it up on the NPR Music app on your iPhone. Because by doing either of those things, you could hear this. Asadiga
Ibowai. Here's the butcher, he has AIDS. Here's the teacher, she has AIDS. Here's the doctor, he has AIDS. Here's my daughter, she has a wonderful disposition. She's all I have left in the world. And if either of you lays a hand on her, I will give you my AIDS.
That is Hasadiga Ibowai, which, as you may have noticed, sounds kind of like Hakuna Matata, but is about some seriously grim topics which go well beyond AIDS. Just fair warning. It treats these topics in a way that is not just irreverent, but blisteringly profane. And most people would argue outright blasphemous. But it is gut-bustingly funny, and I have listened to it about 40-11 times since last week.
Very sincere question. I actually really, really want to see this play. Would listening to the original cast recording spoil elements of the play?
That's a good question.
I have to explain that I wrote the first listen.
We pilfered you from Arts and Life.
Which is the other thing that's making me happy, is that I got to write about this show. I got to hear the album in advance of most people, and I got to write about it for NPR Music. So that is what's making me happy this week, in addition to the show. I have not seen The Book of Mormon because tickets are very hard to come by, and only a couple of people at NPR were invited to see it for the press. So I hope not, although there are a lot of jokes in the songs. But from what I have read, the show is exuberantly staged enough that you will get a whole layer of hilarity above and beyond what's simply on the recording. And plus, the experience of seeing something like this live, with people sort of throwing themselves into performances as bouncy and crazy and silly as that.
Well, and the electricity of a live audience,
Responding to that goofiness. Because even if you've heard the jokes, not everybody in the house will, and you'll get that energy back from them. As funny as that song is, I am not even positive that it's my favorite song in the show, because that honor might go to the song about how when a Mormon missionary has an awkward and inappropriate feeling for his mission partner, he should just turn it off like a light switch. The title of the song is Turn It Off. It starts as a kind of ballad, and then it turns into, but you'll understand why I like it when I tell you that that this song builds to a wildly upbeat finale with the chorus singing cheerfully along and everyone tap dancing madly. Even on the cast album, you can hear the jazz hands.
Excellent. Very good. Nice. Thank you, Trey Graham. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
I thought maybe that I was going to be happy about Top Chef Canada, which is a new Canadian incarnation of Top Chef. And I was like, free extra season of Top Chef. But it's not that good. Yeah. It's kind of boring. It's just cooking in a boot, and that's about it. It's not up to a good season of Top Chef so far. Compared to Project Runway Canada, which is fantastic.
You have said, yes.
And yeah. Project Runway Australia, which may be even better.
Hmm. Is the problem that they don't have cuisine in Canada?
No, it's not.
It's that everything's in metric.
Well, it's a boot, 3 liters. There is, in the first episode, a guy makes a seal flipper.
Awesome.
So
I take it back.
See, Heidi Klum's husband.
Fantastic.
Makes you.
Anyway, so Top Chef Canada, not quite what's making me happy. What is making me happy is bittersweet, and that is that I have officially, once and for all, at least for this season, given up on American Idol. And I was torn about it. I've watched 9 seasons of American Idol, and this this season is what has finally allowed me to divorce myself from just the increasingly infuriating tedium of watching the show. And I thought Linda blogged about it today when we're taping this, today being Monday, and really I thought spoke what I have been speaking, which is just not only are the contestants boring, but the contestants are so obnoxiously, bafflingly, infuriatingly overpraised for every single performance that watching it has just gotten to the point where it makes me so angry. And feeling angry about watching American Idol is just so stupid. So I feel angry, and then I feel stupid for feeling angry, and then I feel angry for feeling stupid
and
for feeling angry.
And then it's just not worth
it.
So what
Linda said that you really want to say is Hasadiga American Idol judges.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
That's exactly what I wanted to say. And it's just, like, getting exasperated about something you care so little about. It's just put me in this place where I realized that I was ultimately deriving no joy whatsoever from it. And I don't feel as culturally, I don't feel culturally obligated to keep up with American Idol the way I did before. I don't feel like, well, I should be the person on the NPR music team who watches American Idol, because now we have Ann Powers, and Ann Powers watches American Idol and actually likes it. I feel so incredibly unburdened.
Yeah, uh-huh. Let it go, Stephen.
Can we bring this back around to the part that's making you happy, since we're supposed to be leaving?
What's making me happy is that I have been unburdened of American Idol.
No. And now let go of it.
It has freed me up to catch up on Top Chef Canada.
Washed in the blood of the lamb.
Very
crappy, crappy lamb.
Very good. Thank you, Stephen Thompson.
Freedom is what is making me happy.
Well, I mentioned a couple weeks ago that what was making me happy at that time was having discovered Cheers on Netflix streaming. Mm-hmm. But little did I know that someone would later point out to me that the Real World season 1 through season 4 is on Hulu Plus. So I personally found myself just diving into the first season of The Real World, which took place in New York many, many years ago, for those of you who are curious about that. 1992, I believe.
Wow. Is this the Puck and Pedro season, or was that two?
That was
Are you on drugs? Why do you have a beeper?
Are you on drugs? Why do you have a beeper? Glenn can quote a few lines from it himself. But what's amazing about it is I had no idea until I saw it again how many times I must have seen it back when it was on and when they used to run it in marathons on MTV, because whole scenes would come up and I would realize I knew everything that was going to happen. I knew exactly which person was going to say what thing. I have seen it a lot, but I've not seen it in a long time because MTV at some point stopped running the early ones, I think in order to avoid pointing up the contrast between the fact that it actually used to be a pretty interesting show, and it did have an element of social experiment and had an element of putting people from different backgrounds together.
Well, certainly earnestness. It had that early 90s distressed font earnestness.
Absolutely it did. And I think that, you know, it's not that show anymore. Now it's mostly people getting naked in hot tubs. They don't really want to point that out. You wouldn't want to put the Pedro season on now and point out what that show used to be and what it's like now that it's just sheer unadulterated trash. But watching the first couple seasons of it, I went back and I was like, this used to be really kind of interesting. I remember why I actually used to like and watch this show.
You used to be able to tell yourself that this show was important, that it was saying something about society, that it was reflecting society.
Not even just important, but just interesting.
Like, and
interesting friendships
different
would
pop and new
up.
And, you know.
Right. And you don't have participants who know exactly how the interviews are going to be cut and how they're going to look.
Right.
They're not as much going for, like, the zing line that's going to lead into commercial as much as they do now. And you can just tell. And all these shows are like that. But when I went back and watched the first one, the first season, I just thought, I was not as wrong about this show as I came to believe I was. It was still interesting. And I was tweeting back and forth with a couple of people who had sort of the same reaction. And we talked, among other things, about how much more deliberately paced it is in the early seasons, how it's not as much of a slam bang, everything, you know, loud music, whatever. So it's been a lot of fun to sort of go back to the early 90s.
Well, plus you can see the roots of how that show launched the hip-hop career of Heather B.
Heather B.
And of course, the other interesting thing about it is that this show sort of paved the way for all the candid reality shows that came after, not the game show ones and not the variety ones, but the candid ones. And so you do see how mesmerizing it was when they used to have fights that were actually organic, that came from people actually having a conflict. In some ways,
about the producers bull baiting.
And sometimes an important conflict, sometimes a real conflict that you could recognize as the kind of thing that people in real life who don't know each other will have conflict about.
Right.
It's some of which was racially based and sexual orientation based and really interesting kind of tangles that they would have and things where you could really see both sides of an argument that was legitimately coming from people who were intelligent. They were just arguing and upset about something. And of course now that's the kind of thing that has become such a trope in other shows, but you can see some of the origins of why people originally got tied up in fighting is that if when it's organic, it's actually interesting. You learn something about the way people are behaving. And it's the same thing with flirtation and a bunch of other things that happened in that season in just a much smaller, more natural, less exaggerated.
But, I mean, that was also setting some of the grammar of this kind of reality show, as you mentioned. I mean,
absolutely.
The confessional. I think this was the very first show with confessionals,
It probably was. It probably was. Confessionals like they did, yeah.
It does feel like when you watch the first season, you feel like you're Margaret Mead. And then when you watch the latter seasons with the hot tubs and the drunkenness, you feel like Jane Goodall.
Yeah. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Anyway, so that's what's making me happy this week is the first season of The Real World on Hulu Plus. Thank
awesome.
You for making that available to me, MTV rights-owning people. So that's it for this week's show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker.
That's how it's spelled.
You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You don't have to mean it. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. And you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. And thanks to all of you guys for being here as always.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here. And we will see you back here next week.